I don't care about the money, David said. I want the ring. What have you done with it?
I didn't say I took it.
Graham, you did. David put his hand on the blue-flowered shoulder. Look, I'll get you a dozen candy bars if you want them. Just give the ring back to me. You know you wouldn't like it if I got into your things and took something.
It wasn't yours, Davy, Mrs. Ruggles said. It was your daddy's. Your daddy was wearing that ring the day he left here. The only way you could have it is if he's come back again and given it to you. You've been with your daddy. You know where he is. Why are you keeping it a secret?
I swear, Graham, that's not my father's ring, David said. I haven't seen my dad since I was a little kid. You've got things all mixed up.
I'm an old woman, Davy, and I want to see my boy before I die.
Then I hope you will, but I can't bring him to you. I didn't get that ring from my father.
Then where did you get it?
Irma Ruggles asked him.
I found it.
Where?
On the sidewalk.
If it's just a found thing, why does it mean so much to you?
The old woman turned to Susan.
Where did Davy get the ring?
He found it, Susan said thinly. Just like he said he did.
You were with him?
Yes. It was lying there on the pavement, and the sun hit it, and the stone sort of caught the light, and David picked it up and said, somebody must have dropped this. The words came stumbling forth, sounding so contrived to her own ears that she almost strangled on them. She was not surprised to see the look of disbelief on the wrinkled face.
There was no stone in the ring,
Irma Ruggles said with dignity.
There was a tree. The German words go all the way around the ring, and the tree is in the middle.
Silence settled heavily upon the room. Susan closed her eyes.
When I open them, she told herself, this whole room will have vanished and this dreadful woman with it. 10 years will have gone by, and I will be grown and far away in my private cabin on the shore of a lake. I will look out through my fine window onto deep, calm green, with millions of tiny ripples shining and sparkling in the sunlight, and a breeze will come, clean and sweet across the water, smelling of pine trees. I will think back and ask myself, where was I 10 years ago? What was I doing? What was I feeling? And I won't even remember.
But when she opened her eyes once more, it was all still there. The cramped room with the two narrow beds stripped of their sheets to reveal the thin, sagging mattresses, the portable television set sitting lifeless on its stand in the corner, the old lady glowering from the depths of her chair. Through the window behind her there was another window, and another bedroom, and another woman. The neighbor woman stared at Susan with undisguised interest, and then glanced past her at the unmade beds, and began to smile.
Come on, Sue, David said in a low voice. I'll walk you home.
But you haven't gotten what we came for.
That's okay. I'll get it later. Graham will change your mind.
No, she won't, Susan thought with a sick sort of despair. She will keep that ring hidden away like a squirrel with a nut day after day, week after week, while she waits for David to produce his father. And then one day she will realize that the father is not coming, and she will bring out the ring from under her pillow or out of a cold cream jar or wherever she has put it, and she'll say to David's mother, look what Davy says he found on the sidewalk, though he didn't really find it there, because this girl he brought home with him one day, who was supposed to have been with him when he discovered it, couldn't describe what it looked like. Why did they lie to me about this? Where did he really get it? And David's mother will say,
she could not force her mind any farther.
You don't have to walk with me, she said to David. It's not far. I can go home by myself.
I'd like to take you.
No, please. I don't want you to.
Susan turned quickly away from him.
I'm glad to have met you, Mrs. Ruggles.
Whirling on her heel, Susan rushed through the bedroom doorway and stumbled through the living room, bruising her shins against the edge of a coffee table that was lost in a shadow pocket by a plastic-covered sofa. She pushed past a chair and found the door to the outside. She pulled it open and burst through, and the soft, spring dusk came upon her in a gush of cool air and golden slanted light. The car that David had driven the times he'd picked her up at the house was parked at the curb, and a tall woman with thick, dark hair was lifting a laundry basket from the back seat. Another time, Susan would have looked at her with curiosity, but now she sped by with hardly a glance, intent only on putting distance between herself and the place she was leaving. Halfway down the block, she began to run, grateful for the cold purity of the wind against the heat of her face.
"That is where David lives," she thought incredulously. "That is where he goes when he leaves school in the afternoon. That place and the people in it are his life."
"The winds of freedom blow," Susan thought, and she could have wept for him. But the panic that had started to build within her now began to take her over. David's grandmother was not dumb. She was old, yes, and confused, but there had been a sharpness in her eyes and a craftiness in the way she had managed to twist the conversation that denied stupidity. David would not have an easy time getting the ring away from her. That much Susan knew with certainty. With the ring in her possession, and among the shifting lights and shadows of her faded mind, Mrs. Irma Ruggles was dangerous.
"We've got to do something, but what?"
Susan asked herself frantically. David could not handle the situation alone, and she herself could do nothing to help him. There was one person who would know what to do, one person who always knew what to do. Susan entered her house by the front door and went straight through the hall to the stairs. She could hear the voices of her father and brothers raised in friendly argument in the den. From the kitchen there came the clink of pans and dishes. The warm, familiar odors of the dinner hour filled the stairwell. Susan went up the stairs and down the hall to the phone. She looked up a number in the directory, lifted the receiver, and punched in the numbers. A woman's voice answered.
"Hello? Is this Mrs. Garrett?" Susan said. "I'm trying to get in touch with Mark Kinney. Is he there with Jeff?" "Oh, good. Please, can I speak to him?"
Chapter 16. The Sunday paper carried the complete story.
"Terrible," Mr. McConnell said. "Utterly unbelievable. What kind of maniac would do such a thing? What sort of motive could there have been? The man wasn't carrying anything of value. All that was missing when they found him were a couple of dollars and his Stanford-class ring."
"His poor wife," Mrs. McConnell exclaimed. "With a baby coming. How dreadful this is for her. It says the funeral will be on Tuesday. You will be going to it, won't you, Sue?"
"No,"
Susan said.
"Mom, I just can't."
She could not shift her gaze from the photograph on the front page. The picture was not a recent one, for it lacked a mustache, and devoid of this protective camouflage, the mouth looked young and oddly vulnerable. What could not be denied were the eyes. Susan had looked into those cool, challenging eyes 5 mornings a week for the past school year.
"Good morning, class."
"Good morning, Mr. Griffin."
"Sue, dear," her mother said, "I know how you feel and how hard it must be for you, but I really feel you ought to go. It's bound to mean something to his wife to see that his students were fond enough of him to turn out for his funeral. Perhaps Dad and I should go with you. After all, Mrs. Griffin was here in our home just the other night."
"Does it say how he was killed?"
Craig asked with interest.
"They're doing an autopsy. There were bruises on the body, but no other signs of violence."
Mr. McConnell was scanning the story.
"He had a history of heart-related problems, so they think it's possible he suffered coronary arrest. This says police were led to the discovery of the body in a secluded area of the Sandias by a girl named Lana Turnbolt. She and a former boyfriend used to go hiking in the area. Yesterday she was up there with her fiancé for a picnic and found a medicine vial with Griffin's name on it and a few yards away a patch of newly turned earth. She reported this to the police, who investigated and found it was a grave."
"Do you feel real bad, Sue?"
Kevin asked respectfully.
"I never knew anybody who got dead."
"Of course she feels bad," his mother said, putting her arm around Susan's shoulders. "It's a tragic thing.
I just pray whoever did this will be caught and punished to the full limit of the law.
The one clue they mention is a blue windbreaker that was wrapped around the body,
Mr. McConnell said.
It was a man's size, small. It says, Detective James Baca, who is in charge of the investigation, said there were no identifying marks on the jacket. It came from Sears. Millions of people wear these things, Baca said.
We ought to send flowers, Mrs. McConnell said. The shops will be closed today, but I'll order some in the morning. She gave her daughter a squeeze and released her and went over to the stove. How many want eggs this morning? John, I want to talk with you about something, Paula Garrett said. Jeff has been up since dawn working out in the garage on Mark Kinney's car.
So?
Her husband grunted. Tear yourself away from the income taxes and listen to me a moment. This is Sunday, Jeff's one day to relax. He has practice tomorrow and Tuesday, and Wednesday night is the last day of the tournament.
So?
John Garrett said again. Jeff never misses practice. I know. That's just my point. He throws himself so hard into his sports, he needs to get rest when he can. Mark takes advantage of their friendship to a point where it's disgraceful. And as far as I can see, Jeff never gets anything back from it. It's all give on one side and all take on the other. You worry too much, John Garrett said. What's this about Mark Kinney's car, anyway? I didn't think the kid had a car. If he's got his own wheels, how come Jeff drives him around all the time? Mark just bought the car, or I guess he did, Paula said. It's a beat-up old thing, purely second-hand. He and Betsy came over in it yesterday afternoon and drove it straight into the garage. Jeff says he's going to help him fix it up, but there's no helping about it. Mark got a phone call from some girl a couple of minutes after he got here and took off immediately. Now this morning Jeff's out there painting that car all by himself, and it's not even his.
Jeff likes working on cars. He had some other kid's car out there for a while last month. You didn't hit the roof over that.
No, I didn't, because Greg Dart was out there with him working right alongside him. And besides that, he paid Jeff for his work. You can be sure Mark isn't going to fork over a penny. I bet Jeff's even buying the paint.
They've been friends for a long time, Paula.
I know, Jeff's mother said. I can remember the first time he brought Mark home with him. I thought then that their friendship couldn't last a week. That weird little weasel of a boy and our Jeff? Why, they had nothing in common. Jeff would be out back shooting baskets and Mark would be slouching against a tree, staring off into space like he was half asleep. I thought Jeff was just being kind because the boy was new in town and didn't have parents.
Well, likely he was, her husband said.
And I think it shows the goodness in Jeff that he's continued to help the kid. From the things Mark's let drop when he's been over here, I gather he's got no kind of home life. He's got an uncle who beats him and an aunt who won't fix his meals. The only nourishment he gets comes from that greasy spoon diner or out of our refrigerator. No wonder he's attached himself to a solid, well-adjusted guy like Jeff. It's his anchor in life.
Maybe so, Paula said more slowly. I could be overreacting. It's just that I've never been able to get really fond of Mark. He and Jeff are together so much, and he's in and out of here every day, and he's polite enough, but I don't feel I know him at all as a person. Do you?
I never thought about it, John Garrett said. Maybe there's not much there to know. The kid's a shadow of Jeff, trailing along in his footsteps. It's kind of pitiful, actually, since he'll never be able to begin to measure up to him. You can tell he's got a crush on Betsy, but what girl would look twice at him with Jeff around? It's sort of sad.
Well, when you put it that way, Paula said, I guess Jeff's a big enough boy now to handle his own relationships. It's up to the strong in this life to take care of the weak, isn't it? And our boy's pretty special.
Darn right he is, John Garrett said, turning back to his tax return. All you have to do is open the paper or pick up a magazine and you see a bunch of messed up kids in trouble. It makes you wonder where the parents are while all that's going on.
Kathy Griffin lay on her back, staring at the ceiling. She had slept, dreamless, through the night as a result of the sedative they had given her. When she wakened, it had been slowly, in stages. Consciousness had inched upon her, first with the knowledge that she was no longer sleeping, then as she automatically turned and reached into the bed beside her. It was empty.
"He's up ahead of me,"
she had thought drowsily. But even as the words formed in her mind, she had known there was something wrong with them. There were no sounds of movement in the room, no thumps of bureau drawers being opened and closed. The shower was not running in the bathroom. There was no hum of an electric razor.
"Where is Brian?"
And then quickly, she had shoved the question away.
"I will not ask myself now. I'm not ready to think about that yet."
Desperately, she tried to shove herself back into the safe cocoon of oblivion, but it had sealed itself behind her.
"I must sleep. I have to sleep some more."
But while her arms and legs lay weighted upon the mattress, and her body remained a leaden lump, too heavy to think of lifting, her mind kept opening inch by dreadful inch.
"Where is Brian? Where is Brian? Where is he? I know.
There was a crack in the ceiling over the bed. Brian had been planning to fix it during Easter vacation. "It won't take much, just some sort of plaster filler. You'll never get around to that, and you know it. You have a million books you're going to read that week. Well, I'll make the sacrifice. I'll hold myself down to a million minus one and fix the ceiling. We can't have the whole roof caving in on top of Brian Jr." In the far corner of the room there was a cobweb, a wisp of lace caught in a beam of morning sunlight. Had some industrious spider created that masterpiece overnight, or had it been there unnoticed for days? It was strange, the things you saw when you looked at the ceiling, really concentrated on it to the exclusion of everything else. The plaster ran in waves and swirls, and here and there there were little lumps in it, as though it had been spread too slowly and had dried before it was smoothed. "People who do halfway jobs shouldn't do them at all," Brian used to say. If Brian had been a plasterer, the swirls in the ceiling would have been symmetrical and all the lumps would have been smoothed away.
"Where is Brian? I know.
Somewhere in the house, a telephone rang. It rang only once. A moment later, the bedroom door opened a crack and then came open wider. "Oh, you're awake," a woman's voice said.
"Semi-awake," Kathy said. "I feel like I've got a hangover."
"There was a call from your parents. They're getting an afternoon flight and we'll be in late this evening." The owner of the voice came into the room and stood next to the bed.
"What can I get you, hon? Coffee?" "I don't know. Yes, coffee, I guess. You haven't been here all night, have you, Rose?"
"Of course I have. What are neighbors for, if not to be on hand when things happen?" the woman said. "It's a good thing you turned off your cell, or you'd have been up at dawn. There have been a lot of calls on the house phone. Brian's principal called, and several of the teachers, and some professor at the college who said he was head of the English department there. I've kept a list of the names."
"That's good of you, Rose." Kathy pulled herself with effort to a sitting position.
"Well, Brian Jr.'s still with us. He just kicked me a good one."
"How do they all know about it? Is it in the paper?"
"There's a big write-up on the front page," Rose said. "They even have Brian's picture, though it doesn't look much like him without the mustache. I don't know where they got that."
"It was probably taken back when he was at the university. They must have got it out of a yearbook file or something."
Her tongue felt thick and her head ached when she fell back onto the pillow.
"Can I see it?"
"You don't want to read it all, hon. It'll only upset you."
"What is, is," Kathy said. "Reading about it isn't going to make it any worse. Maybe when I read it, it will go into some sort of perspective. Maybe it will start to make sense. Who could possibly hate Brian enough to do this thing? What kind of person hates like that?"
"They'll find him. That's what police are for."
"But they don't know where to start. All they could talk about was the windbreaker.
There has to be something more than that, some better starting place. When I was with them yesterday, I must have been in shock. I couldn't think. Everything they said to me seemed to run in and out of my brain like water. I kept trying to grab hold of things, but they kept sliding away from me before I could put them together to make any sort of meaning.
That was a blessing, maybe.
There was something, the name of somebody, that meant something to me. I remember having a feeling of recognition when I heard it. I started to tell them, and then I couldn't remember any longer what it was I was going to say.
The telephone rang again, clearer, now that the bedroom door was open.
I'll get that, Rose said. And then I'll bring you coffee.
And the paper, Kathy said.
At 11:10 on Sunday morning, Mrs. Irma Ruggles sat in a chair by her bedroom window and played with the circle of gold on the fourth finger of her right hand. First, she turned it so she could see the tree and read the German words. Then she released it and let its own weight twist the ring so that all she could see was the band. The ring was loose on her finger, but not too terribly loose. If it had been even a fraction of an inch smaller, it might have been difficult sliding it over her knuckle.
Whomever this belongs to has a thin hand for a man, thought Mrs. Ruggles, turning the ring again so that the tree appeared on top.
She could not have said exactly when it was that she had stopped thinking of the ring as belonging to her son and had inserted a nameless owner in his place. Yesterday morning, when she had found it in David's bureau, she had been so certain that he had gotten it from his father. The shock of seeing it there, among the dimes and nickels in the box she always visited for candy money, had jolted her terribly. It had been like hearing her son's voice crying out to her across the years. But later, when she had confronted David with her suspicions, things had not occurred as she had expected. He had been rattled, yes, and he had certainly acted guilty, but not guilty as a boy might be who had a glorious secret. I haven't seen my dad since I was a little kid, he had told her, and the words had rung true. David was not good at deception. He could not have falsified the pain in his voice any more than he could have injected convincing sincerity into his next statement, I found it. And the girl, the plain, mousy, bespectacled girl who was so exactly the opposite of any girl she would ever have picked for David, that girl had lied so badly that anyone with half a brain could have realized she was not telling the truth. And then the look on her face when she had been told, there was no stone in the ring, there was a tree. Her eyes had gotten a wild, glazed look, and then she had closed them and stood there silent, as though wishing herself a million miles away. Irma had not accepted it then, perhaps because she did not want to accept it. But little by little, in the long hours since, the dream had fallen away. Her son was not in town. He would not turn up suddenly on the doorstep, his beautiful face alight with joy and love. Her David, the first David, had vanished from their lives with the finality of a bright bird flying straight into the sun, leaving nothing behind him but the memory of a feathered touch and the rustle of restless wings. She would not see him again in this world. And perhaps, if the things the Reverend Chandler preached were true, not anywhere. Those who refuse to shoulder their earthly burdens will never know the glory of everlasting life, the Reverend had said straight from the pulpit 7 years ago, and Irma had refused to attend church since. This had upset her daughter-in-law terribly.
He didn't mean anything personal, Mother Ruggles, she had said. My goodness, with the hundreds of people he has in his congregation, he can't stop and worry about the effect every single thing he says will have on every one of them. How's it going to look if you stop attending services with David and me? Why, people will think I won't take the trouble to bring you.
They won't think that, Irma had told her. They know how responsible you are. Just tell them I'm feeling poorly.
Every Sunday?
I'm an old woman. When you get old, you can feel poorly whenever you want to.
She had meant this as a little joke, but her daughter-in-law had not found it amusing. The fact was, she seldom found anything amusing. Irma was sure that was one main reason why Big David had left her. The winds of freedom are filled with laughter. But now she was wandering. She knew she did that lately. Concentration became more difficult when you grew old. The thing she wanted to think about now was the ring.
If David had not found it and had not gotten it from his father, then where had it come from? He was not going to tell her. That was evident. And his refusal was a challenge to her innate stubbornness. This morning he had come to her again, scrubbed and shining, dressed in his church clothes, as handsome as his father had ever been as a boy, and had said, "Graham, please let me have it." "Have what?" she had asked with feigned puzzlement, knowing that his mother was right in the next room and wondering if he would mention it in her hearing. He wouldn't. "You know," he had said in a low voice, "Graham, look, it's really important to me. You don't know how important. It belongs to somebody, and I have to give it back to him."
"To who?"
"You don't know him, Graham. His name wouldn't mean anything to you. Where are you keeping it? If you'll get it for me, I'll..." "David, aren't you ready yet?" His mother had called from the living room. "We're going to be late and have to sit in the back." And so he had gone, glancing back at her with a pleading, worried look as he left, and she had experienced a subtle shift in her own emotions. David was honestly upset, as upset as she had ever seen him. And the girl had been also. There was something very wrong here, somehow. Where had this ring come from, and why was it so important? She was back to the beginning again. She turned the ring slowly on her finger, staring at it as though the answer might suddenly appear, interspersed with the words of German. Could David have stolen the ring? Such a thing was hard to imagine, but young people today did seem to be under all kinds of intense pressures that drove them to do strange and unpredictable things. Davy didn't have much spending money, and now that he was beginning to date, this might be suddenly important. At the same time, common sense told you that if you were going to steal for money, there were all sorts of things more marketable than a college ring. Lost in contemplation, Irma Ruggles did not hear the front door open, only the sharp click as it was shoved closed. Could time have passed so quickly? She glanced up, startled.
"Davy?"
she called.
"Is that you?"
There was no answer.
"Davy?"
she said again, turning to face the figure that had appeared silently in the bedroom doorway. And then she stopped, bewildered. Her hands rose with a jerk that sent the ring sliding off her finger into her lap.
"Why, you're not Davy,"
she said to the boy with the funny eyes. Chapter 17. The wind began in the early afternoon. It rose slowly at first, but increased steadily, as winds do in the southwest in March, lifting the dust from the vacant lots and unpaved roads and mesas, and sending it sweeping into the town. The Sunday twilight was muted and pink, as the sun's last rays slanted through the thick red air. And when dark came, the wind did not drop, but seemed to grow stronger, whining around the corners of houses and stripping the first new leaf buds from the trees. Susan brought two logs in from the pile beside the garage and built a fire. She felt foolish doing it, for the evening was not cold, but some inner part of her seemed to be freezing. It took some time before she could get the fire to catch. This chore had always fallen to Craig or her father. Once she got it going, she sat on the floor, huddled as close as she could get to the fire screen, taking comfort as much from the friendly, crackling sound as from the heat of the flames. "Are you sure you won't change your mind and come with us?" her mother had asked one final time before they had left. "I know how low you're feeling, but Sunday suppers at the church are always fun, and seeing other people might give you a lift."
"I'm sure," Susan had told her. "I just couldn't face it." "There's going to be a sing-along," Alex had reminded her.
"I said I don't want to come." The thought of the crowded church basement with her parents' friends chattering and munching and hordes of shrieking children racing about between the long, food-covered tables had in itself been enough to exhaust her. Now, alone in the house, she wondered if she had made a mistake in not going. Although she dreamed often of solitude, she had seldom actually experienced it. With the comings and goings of a large family, the McConnell house was seldom empty and almost never silent.
Tonight, its absolute stillness, accentuated by the moan of the wind outside, was oppressive and almost frightening. Hungry suddenly for the sound of human voices, Susan turned on the television and flicked from channel to channel. On one, a comedian and his newly divorced wife were trading insults. On another, a female singer was wailing about the agony of lost love. Ironically, on the third channel, the first words she heard were, "Brian Griffin." For Brian Griffin, Del Norte English teacher, whose body was found yesterday in a shallow grave in the Sandia Mountains. Results of the autopsy show the cause of death to have been coronary arrest, possibly preceded by a severe angina attack. Griffin's wrist and ankles were bound with twine, tightly enough to obstruct circulation to the hands and feet, and there were bruises on his arms and legs, the coroner's report said. Mrs. Catherine Griffin, the wife of the deceased, said that a new prescription for the medication Griffin took for angina was on order at the... Susan turned off the set. In the kitchen, in a pan on the back of the stove, was stew from last night's dinner. Her mother had set it out for her before she had left. "Be sure to eat, Sue," she had told her, and Susan had nodded agreement. Now she went out to the kitchen and stood for a moment in front of the stove, trying to decide if she would be able to face a meal. The mere smell of the food, with its combination of onion and spices, made her slightly nauseated. She had almost decided to put the whole concoction down the disposal when the doorbell rang. Who in the world? Susan hesitated, feeling reluctant to open the door when she was alone in the house. Then she thought of David. Of course, it would be him come to give her a follow-up on the situation with the ring. By this time, Mark would have talked with him, and perhaps they would have worked out a solution. Setting the stew pan back on the burner, Susan went to the door and opened it. To her surprise, she found her visitors to be Jeff and Betsy. "Are you here alone?" Betsy asked, glancing quickly about her. "Yes," Susan said. "The rest of the family is out for the evening." "Well, good. We can talk then. Aren't you going to ask us in?" "Of course, come in," Susan said, stepping back to allow them to enter. Both their faces were red from the wind, and Betsy's hair was wild around her face. "We're on our way to Zuni," Jeff said. "I got the car sprayed gray this morning, and Betsy's borrowed the license off her mom's Honda to use on the drive out there. We figured nobody will be using that car tonight, and we'll get the license back on again before anybody sees it in the morning."
"How are you going to get back?" Susan asked them.
"We've got Griffin's car," Betsy said. "And Mark's going to follow us in Jeff's. After we dump the Chevy, we'll come back with him. He's going to meet us here in a couple of minutes. The reason we stopped here is to tell you that I told my folks I was spending the night with you. I don't think Mom will check it out. If she wants me, she'll call me on my cell. But if for some reason she does happen to call on your house phone, you'll have to handle it."
"How?" Susan asked nervously.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, you're supposed to be so smart. Figure out something. Tell her I'm asleep or in the bathtub or whatever. The main thing is to be sure you get the phone every time it rings tonight. That won't be hard, considering your folks are out."
"The other thing is, we've got to get hold of Dave," Jeff said. "I gave my folks the same story about sleeping at his house. Are you going to see him tonight?"
"Not that I know of," Susan said.
"We tried to stop at his place on the way over here," Betsy told her. "But there was a whole line of cars parked in front like they were giving a party. We didn't think we ought to go in."
"Let's call him from here," Jeff said. "He doesn't have a cell. Do you know his home number, Sue?"
"No," Susan said, "but I can look it up. There's a phone in the den."
She led the way into the wood-paneled room where the fire was burning brightly and casting dancing shadows against the far wall. "I'll find it," Jeff said, picking up the phone directory, which lay on a stand under the wall phone. "I'll read the numbers out to you when you dial. It'll sound more natural if the call comes from you. Are you ready? 268. Susan pushed the buttons. There was a connecting click, and the phone on the other end of the line began to ring. After a moment, a woman's voice answered.
"Hello," Susan said. "Could I speak to David, please?"
"Can I tell him who's calling?" the woman asked.
"It's Susan."
"Okay, just a minute."
The voice moved away from the phone.
"It's somebody named Susan for David. Does he want to take a call right now?"
From somewhere in the background, there was an answer. Susan was aware of the hum of numerous voices. There was a long pause, and then the sound of the receiver being lifted, and David's voice.
Hello?
David, it's Sue. She was not sure he understood it was she who was calling. What's happening over there? Is something the matter?
Yes, David said in a flat voice. My grandmother died this morning.
Oh, David. She was stunned. How awful.
Yeah, it is pretty awful. It happened while my mom and I were at church. We found her lying on the floor in the bedroom. She must have fallen and hit her head when she was getting out of her chair.
How awful, Susan said again.
Is there anything I can do?
The question was ridiculous, and she knew it, but it was the only thing she could think of to say.
No, David said. What is it you called about?
He was far away from her, so far away there was no way to touch him. Susan found herself wondering if she would ever touch him again. The scene yesterday in the bedroom between themselves and the old gray-haired woman would stand between them forever. It would be a memory David would want to thrust away from him, and in her presence, it would come surging back to be relived over and over again. She answered his question.
Jeff and Betsy are here. They're on their way to take the Chevy out to the Pueblo. Jeff has told his parents he's spending the night with you and wants you to cover for him if they should try to call him there.
I can't do that, David said. Our minister's over here and half the people from the church. It's a regular wake. None of them have seen Graham for years, but you'd never know it to listen to them. There's no way I can catch the phone when it rings. One of my mom's friends is acting as telephone secretary.
Oh, Susan said. Well, Jeff will just have to change his story. David, the ring.
It was not the right time to ask it, but she could not let him forget.
Have you gotten it yet?
I don't want to think about that right now, David said.
But, David, you have to. What if somebody else finds it? It has to be there somewhere in the bedroom.
I'll hunt through her stuff, but not tonight. There's too much going on over here. He dropped his voice.
The spacey woman from next door came over a few minutes ago, and you know what she said? That there was a guy in the bedroom with Graham at the time she died. She said she looked across from her bedroom window and saw him standing talking to Graham back behind her chair. She didn't think anything about it at the time because she thought it was me.
But how could there have been anybody? Susan stammered.
There couldn't have been, of course, but she's got my mom and everybody else here all riled up. She says the guy was wearing a brown sweater. I don't even own a brown sweater.
How much did she see? Susan asked shakily. Did she actually see your grandmother fall?
No. She says she looked over once and saw this guy with Graham, and then later she looked again and Graham wasn't in her chair anymore and she didn't see anybody. She's got to be making the whole thing up. Graham didn't have drop-in visitors, and if she did have, they sure wouldn't have been teenage guys. I think the woman's cracked. She's using this as a way to get some attention for herself.
But what if it was a burglar? Susan said. Is anything missing from the house?
Nope. My mom's jewelry, such as it is all in its box, and there's nothing else here that anybody would want to steal. Look, I've got to get back to Mom now. She's taking this hard.
David's voice came from years away.
Did you want anything else?
No, Susan said. I just called about the alibi for Jeff.
David.
She sought for words and could not find them.
I'm sorry, she said lamely.
Yeah, well, so am I. She was quite an old girl, my Gran. The place is going to seem pretty strange without her.
Yes, I imagine so.
Goodbye, David said.
Goodbye.
Susan replaced the receiver on the hook. Jeff and Betsy were looking at her questioningly.
His grandmother died today, Susan said.
Well, what about the cover? Jeff asked.
He said he can't do it.
Shit. That really messes us up if my folks try to get hold of me. Well, there's nothing to do but take the chance, I guess.
He paused, taking in the expression on Susan's face.
Hey, what's with you? You look like you're going to keel over.
Mark has a brown sweater, Susan said. He wears it all the time.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means...
Susan felt the floor tilting strangely beneath her. The room swam about her, and she reached out a hand to brace herself against the wall for support.
When I told Mark about the ring, he said, "Don't worry, I'll get it." And there was someone with her when she died. The woman in the house next door saw him.
You're not making sense, Betsy said. What ring was Mark going to get?
Mr. Griffin's ring, the one that was missing from his finger when they found him. David took it.
Dave did? Jeff said in surprise. Why would he do that?
Because...
She could not try to explain. That part no longer mattered. All that was important now was the horrendous realization that was sweeping over her.
Mark killed that woman. He went over there this morning while David and his mother were in church, and he took the ring from her and he killed her.
You're crazy, Betsy said. Mark would never do a thing like that.
He would, and he did. Suddenly, incredibly, there was no doubt in her mind. We've got to go to the police.
Betts is right. You are crazy, Jeff said.
After all we've gone through to keep this undercover, you think we're going to go to the cops now?
Why, we'd have to tell them everything right from the beginning, the whole bit about the kidnapping and Griffin's dying on us and the burial, and who would ever believe it was an accident, especially if you're going to follow it up with this crazy thing about Dave's grandmother.
It's gone past the point where there's any choice, Susan said. Whatever they do to us, they'll just have to do.
You don't have the right to make that decision, Betsy said. We're all of us in this together. You agreed to help with the kidnapping, and by doing that, you agreed to anything that followed from it. You're committed, just like the rest of us. You can't chicken out now.
Didn't you hear a thing I said? Susan asked her. Mark killed Mrs. Ruggles. He killed an old woman. Mr. Griffin's death was an accident, but this wasn't. Mark knew what he was doing. He planned it, and he killed her.
You don't know that, Jeff said. You don't have proof?
I do know it, and I don't need proof. The police can find that.
Susan was on the edge of hysteria.
If I'm wrong, if Mark had nothing to do with this, if it really was an accident and the old lady slipped and fell, that will show up from her injuries. They can do an autopsy on her the same way they did on Mr. Griffin. But if he did do it...
If he did do it, he did it to protect us, you as well as the rest of us, Betsy said.
He was willing to take that risk in order to keep us safe.
If Dave was stupid enough to take that ring and let his grandmother get hold of it, what could Mark do but get it back any way he could?
But to murder someone?
Like Jeff said, you're only guessing about that, and you're probably wrong.
But if you're not, just remember that Mark did only what he had to do. He's gotten us through this far, and we've got to trust him to get us through the rest of the way.
I don't care what you say, Susan said miserably. I'm going to the police, and I'm going to tell them everything. After that, whatever happens, happens. I'm sorry if the two of you won't back me up, but if you think Mark did only what he had to do, then you can believe the same thing about me. I can't go on like this any longer. It's like a snowball rolling downhill. It's getting worse all the time.
From the street outside, there came the quick, impatient beep of a car horn.
That's Mark, Betsy said. What are we going to do?
It won't do us any good to get rid of the car if Miss Holier-than-thou is going to spill the beans, Jeff said. We've got to keep her quiet.
How?
I'll stay here with her. You run out and tell Mark what's happened. He'll think of something.
You can't tell Mark, Susan cried. He's the very one.
But Jeff's hand was clamped tightly upon her shoulder, and Betsy was already out the door. When she returned a few moments later, Mark was with her. He was still wearing the brown sweater. Chapter 18.
Where's her family?
Mark asked.
Out for the evening, Jeff said. There's nobody else here.
Good. Let's tie her up. The cord on those drapes will work. Betsy, go out to the kitchen and get something to cut them with.
Betsy, no!
Susan twisted in Jeff's grip so that she faced the other girl squarely.
You can't keep doing everything he says, not when you know what he's done.
I don't know that he's done anything, Betsy said.
You don't want to know.
I said, go get a knife.
Mark shifted his gaze from Betsy to Susan. Now, exactly what is it you're trying to sell them? What am I supposed to have done?
You killed David's grandmother, Susan said.
Did Dave tell you that?
No, of course not. He doesn't even realize you knew about his grandmother having the ring. I told you that.
The implications of this last statement struck her with full force.
I did that.
And that's all you're going on? That I knew she had the ring? You knew it too. He regarded her quizzically. If your reasoning holds, that could mean that you killed her.
The woman next door saw you. That is, she saw somebody, a boy in a brown sweater, in the room with Mrs. Ruggles right before it happened.
How could she see that?
Through the window. The house next door has a window exactly opposite the one in Mrs. Ruggles' room.
Susan caught her breath in a half sob.
It was you. It couldn't have been anyone else.
So maybe it was me. I went over and got the ring like I told you I would. Why does that have to mean I killed the old bag? He glanced back at Betsy. You don't think I did that, do you, Bets?
No,
Betsy said softly.
No.
Good. Mark nodded approvingly. Old people fall down, you know. It happens all the time. An old lady tries to jump up out of her chair and stumbles, and down she goes, smacking her head on the windowsill. I ask you, what can I do about it? I wasn't near enough to catch her.
Nothing, Betsy said. You couldn't do anything, not if it happened like that.
She turned and went out to the kitchen. There was the sound of drawers being pulled out and the rattle of silverware. Betsy came back into the room carrying a paring knife.
Will this do okay?
It's not the sharpest thing I've ever seen, but it'll do for a curtain cord.
Mark took the knife from her hand and went over to the window. Held immobile by the grip of Jeff's hands, Susan stood watching as Mark sawed at the cord of the heavy white drapes that were her mother's pride and joy.
They're the most impractical things I've ever seen, Mr. McConnell had said when she bought them. They'll have to be cleaned every other month.
And Mrs. McConnell had said, Oh, I don't think it will be quite that bad. But it had been.
What are they going to do to me? Susan thought, terrified, and at the same time, there was some odd, untouched corner of her mind that was saying, Mom will be so upset about the draperies. Surely there's something else he can use besides those.
What do we do now?
Jeff asked, as Mark came over to them with the cord in his hand.
Tie her, the way we did Griffin. Put her wrists behind her.
And then what?
Jeff loosed his hold on Susan's shoulder, and as she twisted to jerk away from him, he pulled her arms back roughly. An idea occurred to him.
Hey, you're not thinking of doing the same thing with her, are you? Leaving her in the mountains? I don't want to be part of that.
You're part of whatever we do,
Mark said easily. He looped the cord around Susan's wrists and pulled it so tight that she gasped in pain.
But no, that's not the plan. It's too close to the other. People would put two and two together too fast.
Then what?
Lay her down, Mark said, and help me get her ankles. Hey, you, watch it,
as Susan's foot shot out at him.
You kick me and you're going to be sorry.
Down you go,
Jeff said, lifting her easily and laying her squirming body flat on the den floor. He dropped to his knees and bent to pull her legs tightly together.
You want to try to gag her?
No sweat. With the noise that wind's making, she could yell her head off and neighbors wouldn't hear her.
Mark knotted the cord around Susan's ankles and then drew it up to the wrist cord so that her legs were bent sharply at the knees.
That'll keep her from rolling around and getting into trouble.
Okay, you two. He nodded at Jeff and Betsy.
Off to Zuni.
To Zuni? Betsy exclaimed in bewilderment.
Now? What do you mean now? We're half an hour behind schedule. That isn't going to hurt anything, though. We're keeping to the plan. Take the car out there, and I'll pick you up in Jeff's.
But what about Sue? Betsy asked. We're just going to leave her here? What about when her parents come home? As soon as they're in the door, she'll tell them everything that happened.
I don't think she'll do that.
Why not?
Jeff asked.
What's going to stop her?
Look here, Mark, I'm not going to be the one in that Chevy when the sirens start wailing. They won't be wailing, Mark said irritably.
I told you, she's not going to set the cops on us, I guarantee it. What's the matter? Don't you trust me?
Sure, Jeff said. Except I want to know what's happening. I'm not going to get off there on the interstate with that car under me without having any idea what the score is.
Then take your own car, damn it, Mark said. I'll drive the Chevy. Just get a move on, will you? We want to get back before morning.
Trust him, Jeff, Betsy said. Mark knows what he's doing.
Jeff, please, Susan said imploringly. Don't leave me here alone with him.
I want to know how you're going to make sure Sue doesn't talk, Jeff said stubbornly. Like I said, I don't want to get out on that highway.
You won't be risking a thing, Mark told him.
His voice was tightly controlled, but his eyes were beginning to take on a glint like cold steel. The lids had slipped down so that only the pupils showed, small black dots in the half-moons of gray iris.
I told you, I'll drive the Chevy. If anybody is taking a risk, I'm the one. You and Betsy will be in your car, just as legal as legal. If you get stopped, you show the registration and you're fine.
How could we explain what we were doing out there a couple of hundred miles from home? Jeff asked.
Nobody's going to ask you that. Mark's anger was beginning to surface. If anybody did, you could say you were eloping. That would shake your folks up enough so they'd never think to ask you anything else.
He got to his feet.
I'm telling you for the last time, boy, I'll handle things. I've done all right up till now, haven't I? After you leave, Sue and I are going to have a little talk. And when we're through, she will have changed her mind about everything. Sue's not a disloyal person, not basically. She's just gotten a little mixed up on her values.
You think you can convince her? Jeff asked doubtfully.
Sure he can, Betsy said. He convinced her the last time, didn't he, after she and Dave found Mr. Griffin? If he could do it then, he can do it now.
Okay. Jeff fumbled in his pocket and drew out a key. This is for the Chevy.
Jeff, please.
Susan tried again in desperation.
I left your keys in the car. I didn't think we'd be tied up here so long.
Mark took the key from Jeff's hand.
Stop worrying. Leave things to me, okay?
Okay, Jeff said again. Well, I'll go on then. You ready, Bets?
I've been ready for ages,
Betsy said. She flashed Susan a sudden, bright smile that seemed to come full-blown out of nowhere.
You listen to Mark, Sue. Remember, he knows best. I hate you,
Susan whispered. She did not mean it to be a whisper, but in her twisted position, she found she could get no breath to accelerate her voice.
I hate you all.
We're not too fond of you either, little snot, Betsy said, her smile fading. Come on, Jeff. Let Mark take care of her. They left. Susan heard the front door open and close. Then there was silence. It was not the same silence that had filled the house earlier in the evening, for this time she was not alone. Mark had moved to the other side of her, and Susan had to lift and turn her head in order to see him.
You're not going to talk me into anything, she said. I'm not going to waste my time trying, Mark said. What are you going to do? I'm going to open the windows and let in a little air, he told her.
It was not an easy thing to open the draperies with the cord gone, but he managed it by sliding them along the rods by hand. Then he unlatched the windows and raised them as high as they would go. The wind came sweeping into the room with all its stinging, dust-laden force, knocking the shade askew on a lamp at the end of the sofa and sending a figurine on the mantel crashing onto the floor. The flames leapt high in the fireplace, sending a spray of sparks out through the screen.
Watch out, Susan gasped. You'll set the house on fire.
Setting fire to a place isn't that easy, Mark said lightly. It takes more work than that.
What do you mean?
You've got to get the curtains started. That's what makes a place really go up. That's what happened to our house back when I was living in Denver. First the curtains, and then, whoosh, the whole thing.
I know, Susan said. You told me. That's how your father died, and I'm sorry. Mark, please, cut me loose.
These cords hurt. They're cutting right through the skin.
Don't be sorry, Mark said, ignoring the rest of her statement. He had it coming. You know what that bastard was going to do? Have me stuck in the JD home.
Why?
Susan mouthed the question without interest. Was this how Mr. Griffin had felt, lying there by the stream, hour after endless hour? Oh, please, I hope it wasn't, she thought wretchedly. I hope he fainted or went unconscious or something so he couldn't feel any longer.
Because this guy and I wrote some checks and signed my dad's name, Mark said. They weren't even for all that much, and the old man could afford to cover them, but do you think he would? No way. Not my good old dad. To the wolves with the kid, he said, even if the kid was his only son.
Mark, please, untie me.
So you can run to the cops? You must think I'm pretty stupid. Why would I let you do that?
Because you have to, Susan said with more bravado than she felt. My parents will be home in an hour or so, and I'll tell them anyway. Keeping me tied like this for that length of time isn't going to keep me quiet, so why do it?
She paused, and then, with one last hope of reaching him, cried,
Go with me. Let's go together and tell them. Oh, Mark, there's got to be one place where we can clear the air. Let's just go and say how terrible it's been and how awful we feel, how the whole thing is. Can't we?
No, Mark said. We can't.
And he lit the curtain. He lit it with a rolled newspaper that he had picked up, somehow without Susan's noticing, from the coffee table. He touched it to the fire, and he reached across and touched it to the drapes. He held it there a moment. Despite the wind, the drapes took a little while to catch. They're such nice, thick material, Mrs. McConnell had said, and yes, they were that, for he held the flame at the edge for a long moment, and Susan, lying prone on the floor, watched, and her throat was frozen closed so that she could say nothing. She watched the long red splinters of fire licking at the edges of the curtains and watched them darken and turn first brown and then black, and finally the red began on the edges, and in an instant it was leaping upward and gripping and climbing, and Susan tried to scream, but no sound came.
You're wondering about Jeff and Betsy, Mark said. Sure, they'll be pissed, but what can they do, right? I mean, they're not in much of a position to do anything. Betsy's the one who got caught in that parking lot with the Chevy. Jeff painted it. Nobody helped him. Anything that's happened, they're not just in on. They're it.
He stepped back from the flaming drapes and looked down at Susan.
You're okay, Mark said. I never wanted anything bad to happen to you, Sue, but I never thought you'd start acting this way. When you're part of something, you can't just start switching yourself around, you know?
The flames on the curtains were growing. Like strange golden flowers, they were bursting into bloom, and the blossoms changed to red and orange and once again gold. Up, up they climbed, and the heat was stretching itself into the room so that Susan, lying half the room away from the draperies, could feel it. Now it was licking the ceiling.
What happens to ceilings when heat touches them?
They begin to crack. She had never asked herself such a question before, but now she did. Simply because the question was there before her, and lying where she was, she could see the cracks beginning and running in sudden, explosive lines away from the window, and then darkening until they looked like sections in a cake that had been placed in the oven and forgotten.
I will be burned alive,
Susan thought. But she could not believe it because the boy standing in front of her was Mark. He was standing there quiet in the center of the room, and there was no longer anger on his face. His was a quiet, beautiful face with a wide, smooth forehead and a sweet, strong mouth and eyes with the glow of far places and lovely dreams.
I love him, Susan thought, realizing it for the first time, and I hate him, and he is going to kill me. Mark,
she tried to cry, but no sound came.
Mark, Susan cried in silence. Mark, help me, Mark, help me. Mark, you can't mean this, Mark. It can't be real. Mark, Mark.
But it was real, and Mark was not looking at her at all. His mind was somewhere else, in another day, at another time, and it was not this fire, but another that blazed before his eyes.
He was going to turn me in, he said softly. His only son, his only child. The bastard was going to turn me in.
He crossed the room to the window and threw a leg across the ledge. It was in the last instant before the end of consciousness that Susan saw the two other figures standing there. The man who reached up and caught hold of Mark and yanked him out over the sill into the night outside. And the woman with the stricken face.
I am going to die,
Susan screamed silently in the great bursting consciousness that was still her mind. How else could this end? What else could ever happen?
I'm going to die,
she screamed to the woman in the window.
You're glad, aren't you? What else can you be but glad?
Kathy Griffin looked straight at her, and her eyes held no hatred. They were gentle, sad, accepting eyes.
I would never wish that upon you,
the eyes said. Chapter 19. Mrs. McConnell rapped lightly on the bedroom door and then opened it and entered without waiting for an answer.
Good news, Sue, she said. Kathy Griffin's baby was born yesterday, and it's a boy. It's in the morning paper.
That's nice, Susan said dully. Her mother came over and seated herself on the edge of the bed.
Sue, she said, you can't go on like this. It's been 10 days now, and it's time you began to get yourself together. We've got to discuss what happened.
I don't want to discuss it, Susan said. I don't want to think about it.
You have to. It's only by facing things that you ever put them behind you.
The firmness in Mrs. McConnell's voice belied the worry in her eyes. You've never asked why Kathy Griffin and Detective Baca came to our house that night.
Does it matter? Susan said.
It certainly does. It was their coming there that saved your life. It was reading the name of Lana Turnbold in the paper that morning that started Kathy Griffin thinking. She had heard the name the day before from Detective Baca, but she had been in such a state of shock at the time that it hadn't meant anything to her. When she read it in the paper, she realized this was the same girl who had supplied Mark Kinney with a stolen English paper, and that the former boyfriend who had been with her when she discovered the picnic area by the waterfall must have been Mark. She remembered she had met Mark here at our house a couple of nights before, and he had been introduced to her as a friend of yours. She knew, too, that you were supposedly the last person to have seen her husband alive, and she was certain you had not told the truth about the circumstances. She started putting the pieces together, and while they didn't make a complete picture, they fit well enough to raise some strong questions in her mind. She called Detective Baca and suggested that you be interviewed again, by both of them together. That's the reason they came over that evening.
But why didn't they ring the doorbell? Susan asked. Why did they come around to the back of the house and look in the window?
They intended to ring the bell, but when they pulled up in front of our house, Kathy recognized her husband's car. You can imagine the effect that had on her. She was stunned. She and Detective Baca decided to circle the house and see if they could get any clue as to what was going on inside without frightening away whoever was there.
But Jeff had painted the car, Susan said, and Betsy changed the license plate.
Remember, honey, it was nighttime, her mother said. In the dark, it's impossible to tell the difference between a gray car and a green one. Kathy never looked at the license plate. She looked inside the car and knew the patched upholstery. She had ridden in that car so often, there was no way she could have been fooled by a new paint job.
Okay, now I know, Susan said. Do we have to keep talking about it?
Yes, her mother said. We need to talk about it at length with somebody who can help us understand exactly what happened to you and to the others who were under Mark's influence. Yesterday afternoon, your father and I had a counseling session with a psychologist. Detective Baca recommended him to us, and we found it very helpful.
You and Dad went to a psychologist? Susan exclaimed, surprised out of her lethargy.
But why? There's nothing wrong with the two of you.
You don't have to have something wrong with you to need help in understanding things, Mrs. McConnell said.
Listen, I want to read you something. She drew a folded paper from her shirt pocket. This is a description of a certain personality type. She began to read.
This individual has a behavior pattern that brings him repeatedly into conflict with society. He is incapable of significant loyalty to individuals, groups, or social values. He is selfish, callous, irresponsible, impulsive, and totally unable to experience guilt. His frustration level is low. He cannot stand to be thwarted. He tends to blame others or offer plausible rationalizations for his behavior. She paused. Sound familiar? When Susan did not answer, her mother continued. There's more. This individual is unique among pathological personalities in appearing, even on close examination, to be not only quite normal, but unusually intelligent and charming. He appears quite sincere and loyal and may perform brilliantly at any endeavor. He often has a tremendous charismatic power over others. Now, do you recognize someone? It's a description of Mark, Susan said. It's a clinical description of a psychopath. Susan stared at her mother. Is that what the psychologist told you? The first part of the description is a definition published by the American Psychiatric Association. The second part is paraphrased by the psychologist. What will be done about him? Susan asked. What will be done about all of us? Our lawyer has requested that Mark be tried separately, Mrs. McConnell told her. In fact, he will probably face three trials, one for his part in Brian Griffin's death, one for the possible murder of Mrs. Ruggles, and one for what he attempted to do to you. The lawyer feels that he may be able to get the charges against David, Betsy, and Jeff reduced to second-degree murder. I hope he can, as that might make the difference in whether they will serve time in a prison or in a juvenile facility. And me? Asked Susan. You weren't actually involved in what took place in the mountains, Mrs. McConnell said. That fact is in your favor. If you agree to turn state's evidence, you might be let off. The lawyer is working on that now. Otherwise, the charge will probably be manslaughter. Does turning state's evidence mean I will have to testify against the others? You will have to go on the stand and tell the truth, her mother said. No matter how hard it is, you will have to describe exactly what happened, your part and their part, Mark's part. You will have to tell it all. I don't think I can, Susan said. You can, and you must. Her mother reached over and took her hand. You'll do whatever has to be done. Meanwhile, Dad and I think it would be a good idea to get some family counseling to help us all through this difficult time. Will you agree to that? The whole family? Susan asked. We're in this together, aren't we? Whatever happens to you happens to all of us. Perhaps we'll grow closer through this somehow. Perhaps we'll all understand each other better. There must have been something lacking in our life together if you needed someone like Mark to fill in the gap. Mrs. McConnell got to her feet, giving Susan's hand a quick squeeze before releasing it. You've stayed in this room long enough. Get your hair combed and come downstairs. I want you to come with me when I go shopping for curtains. White ones? Susan said with an effort. Something darker, I think. Maybe taupe. After her mother left the room, Susan sat a long time unmoving. When she rose at last, it was to go over to her desk and open the top drawer. She took out an envelope and withdrew from it a sheet of paper. Attached was a note. I found this in his briefcase. He didn't have a chance to give it back to you. It was signed C.G. How long ago it seemed that she had written this final song for Ophelia. It was almost like reading a poem written by a stranger. Where the daisies laugh and blow, where the willow leaves hang down, Nani, Nani, I will go, there to weave my lord a crown. Willow, willow by the brook, trailing fingers green and long, I will read my lord a book, I will sing my love a song. Though he turn his face away, Nani, Nani, still I sing, ditties of a heart gone gray, and a hand that bears no ring. It was the last verse that he had underlined. Water, water, cold and deep, hold me fast that I may sleep. Death with you is hardly more than the little deaths before.
Below this, in Mr. Griffin's small, precise handwriting, there was a message. Miss McConnell, it pleases me to see the growing maturity of your work. It is indeed the little deaths, the small, daily rejections of our well-meant offerings, that render the soul lifeless. It is an adult thought, well expressed. I am glad that you are a junior, for it will allow me one more year in which to work with you. I look forward to watching your continued development as a writer, and hope that I may be able to contribute toward it. Brian Griffin. If she had been the Susan of 2 weeks before, she would have wept. But this new Susan had cried herself dry of tears. She replaced the paper in the drawer and went to comb her hair. This has been an Hachette audio production of Killing Mr. Griffin, written by Lois Duncan, read by Dennis Holland. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Mark Kondracki. Post-production by Out Loud Audio, New York City. Killing Mr. Griffin is also available in print from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1978 by Lois Duncan. Audio production copyright 2010, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.